great honor for me to be here and to start this series of lectures. I wish the series all the best, and I hope to contribute to them becoming a feature here at the EU Center of Excellence for the years to come. I'm also very thankful to your kind words, and in order not to lose time, I would propose that we start rolling. So I want to do two things, which is a daring thing to do. First, refer to financial crisis in history and try to distill some elements of interest that are absolutely necessary if one wants to really grasp what's going on lately in Europe and in the United States, fortunately not in Canada. Then talk about economic policy responses, what governments do, what they did in the past and what they are doing actually. And third, what a history of economic thought a perspective can do by shedding light to patterns of thought that are very important and unique. And I'm going to use all these insights to talk about the crisis in the Eurozone and in Greece, and I will try to divide my time equally between these two parts. Let me brief you about two important sources if you are interested in the topic. One is a book by Charles Kindleberger, Manias, Panics and Crashes. He wrote it in 1978. It is still in print. The latest edition has a co-author, Robert Aliber. It's a very good book written at a time of prosperity when no financial crisis was in sight. And Kindleberger explained the whole process of how the economy evolves at a time where every economist thought that doing models and abstract thinking and exploring equilibria situations in the economy, Kindleberger did something very innovative and looked back in history and gave us this insight, how crises evolve. First you have an innovation, this brings investment, this brings monetary expansion, a euphoria, banks jump in, give credit, profits are made, prosperity enters the scene, everyone finds employment, everything runs smoothly. Then either the market gets saturated or something else happens, a reverse, a critical stage goes through, then speculation starts, fraudulent activities, debt recalls, money gets, there is a monetary contraction, and the crisis is there. Now, the important thing for Kindleberger was that there is a lender of last resort, always. A lender of last resort was not at its place during the depression of the 1930s, and this was the reason why Europe especially went all the way to a second world war. And this is also the way why Hitler took power in Germany and things started, getting very sad. Now, this insight, the absence of a lender of last resort, was thought about before Kindleberger wrote, and was instrumentalized after the Second World War with the creation of the World Bank and the IMF. Now, a second important book that came out just a couple of years ago, this time is different, by Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff, is a summary of all crises that were registered anywhere and in any place in any time. And they make the case that certain fundamentals in economics have to be respected if you don't want crisis. The title is a bit misleading because it is this time is different. And this time is different is always the slogan, the proposition that some economists give in order to distract from what's happening right now. And if it has some bad sides, they argue, don't worry, this used to be bad in the past, now it's different, and you don't have to worry, and don't make the markets nervous. Now, Reinhardt and Rogoff attacked this, but somehow in their title they forgot the question mark. Very quick, what is a financial crisis? It's the sudden loss of the value of assets, a shock to the real economy and to incomes of people. It can be short term, 6 months, 3 months, long term. It can be regional. It may affect one country. It can become global if there is contagion from one country to another. Also, you have to understand that this phenomenon is an old phenomenon, and it has many names in the past. It used to be called a credit crisis, a commercial crisis, because trade was very important in the 18th and 19th century. Other economists spoke about the trade cycle. Or industrial fluctuations, meaning the crisis comes from industry and industrial activity that goes up or down. Others spoke about business cycles. So it's the same thing. Today we use the term financial crisis because we put emphasis on financial intermediation. And what we really mean and the forms that the financial crisis can take is the next slide. It can be a credit crisis or, next slide is this. It can be a banking crisis, a sovereign debt crisis, a domestic debt crisis, an exchange rate crisis, or a hyperinflation crisis. It can take different forms, and sometimes a sovereign debt crisis is also an exchange rate crisis. So it has many faces, and it's a creature that you cannot beat very easily because you cut off one hand and two other hands appear. Let me now go into some of famous crises of the past. Of course, I cannot, cover everything here, but there were crises in times of absolute monarchy in Europe that were the government, the state, was partially or wholly responsible for the crisis. Take the bankruptcy of Spain, for example, in 1557. The government had over-issued money, and there was a huge inflation that brought the country, which was a naval power and superpower, a colonial power, to bankruptcy. And Spain faded away as an economic superpower because of that. The tulip mania in the Netherlands was a very short-lived experiment of high speculation with tulips. Only 3 months. Lots of people lost their money, but a small segment of that society, no contagion whatsoever. The Mississippi and the South Sea bubble had the effect that the first one was in France, the second in England. Again, people who exploited investment opportunities with fraudulent practices, John Law in France and the South Sea bubble, the South Sea Company shareholders in Great Britain. And the other collapses were of banking houses, the Neufville, Fordyce, the assignats scheme in France, in revolutionary France, issuing money with the property of confiscated church lands as a collateral, and then losing control of how much money you issue, and not computing the value of the church lands, and hyperinflation and restoration of Napoleon. Now the story continues with other major panics and events. In 1837, Jackson, with his specie circular, demanded that debt be paid to the United States government only in gold sovereigns and not in paper money. And this creates a huge panic in the country, since everyone who has debt has to pay taxes, has to find gold, and there is, you know, the first real banking crisis in the United States with many banking failures, etc. Railway mania, as the name indicates, overinvestment in railways at a time when people thought that driving by train will make you dizzy and you will going to faint, you know, if the train moves with 50 kilometers per hour. Ohio life crisis, first insurance company to get broke. Overend and Gurney, a major banking house in Britain, next to the Bank of England, the most important bank of the country, collapses because of failed investments that the owners actually did. Black Friday in New York after the Civil War and the move from the bimetallic standard to the gold standard. Vienna crash, the first stock market crash used by Karl Marx in his writings as the first international crisis, because it occurred in Vienna, but contagion was there. It was felt in Hamburg and in London and in Frankfurt and in Paris and in the United States as well. It was the first global crisis that was recorded. Union Générale is a major insurance company in Paris. 82 is the breakdown of the Paris Stock Exchange, and the first bankruptcy of Argentina in 1890. Again, because of overinvestment and of issuing of government bonds that were very, you know, very with short periods of maturity and high interest rates. The story continues with a long list, and this is not exhaustive, of phenomena of crisis in the 20th century, totally unregulated investment trusts like the Knickerbockers fail, they create the panic of 1907, then German hyperinflation after the Versailles Treaty because of the overissue of money, since the Germans wanted to avoid paying the high reparations. 1929, the Wall Street crash, and then the Great Depression, which was the worldwide phenomenon. Then for a long period of time, no crisis whatsoever. Then devaluation of the pound, oil crisis, then 87 stock market crash in New York, 30% down, but regional phenomenon and short-lived. The biggest economy of the time, Japan, slides into depression and still finds itself there. Swedish and Finnish banks collapse after the privatization of the banking sector in this country. Now we have entered the so-called globalization period after the breakdown of the Soviet Union. And we have crises that occur either in major European states like the United Kingdom in 1992 with speculation against the British pound. That's when George Soros became a billionaire. And then in less developed parts of the globe, in Mexico, when Mexico at first entered NAFTA with Canada and the United States, and then had economic troubles because of its poor economy. Southeast Asia, foreign capital coming and going and leaving ruins behind. Russian crisis, over issue of money again, dot-com bubble in the United States, and Argentina in 2001, after having pegged its money to the dollar for a long period of time. Now, all these phenomena make one think, how can they happen, and what do economists say about this? And I don't want to be exhaustive here. I just wanted to indicate that many people have written about this crisis and tried to offer explanations. The first one was the quantity theory of money, which is quite similar to what Milton Friedman and the monetary school told us some decades ago, that if you issue more money than your production, then prices rise. So you have a crisis phenomenon in inflation that brings the economy down. This was the oldest and the very current theory. But in between, there were theories about how to regulate the banking system, which were the underlying theme between the banking versus currency school debates and the bullionist controversies. We had the Marxian explanation of crisis in the early 20th century, Wigzell and the natural rate of interest, the overinvestment theory of Mises and Hayek, then 1936 Keynes, in the United States, the debt deflation theory by Irving Fisher. If you want, we can return during the discussion and I can brief you more about what they say. But one major classification is, on the one hand, monetary policy is the key to understand financial crisis. This lies also under the overinvestment theory and the natural rate of interest and the quantity theory of money. And a second explanation is structural deficiencies in the economic system, and this is the Keynesian explanation. There were people who didn't contribute to a theoretical understanding of crisis, but did the important work in collecting data and explaining how and why and a crisis situation may occur. And you see some names here. Joseph Schumpeter is obviously the most known person, but Wesley Mitchell, they have written, both of them and the other guys, have written very big books full of statistical data to explain the ups and downs in economic activity. Now, there are some important policy milestones because first, governments after the times of absolute monarchy became more democratic and governments were asked to intervene. And so many important policy measures were introduced, first and foremost in the Bank of England really was a lender of last resort in the railway crisis, in the Overeen-Gurney collapse. They relaxed the Bank Charter Act and tried to inject money in times of crisis to prevent the worst. And the inauguration of the Federal Reserve in 1913 in the United States was also a move towards a centralization and a regulation of the banking system. The recovery policies of the New Deal were an important policy milestone. Of course, this is not crisis prevention, but crisis cure. Roosevelt's brain trust, which was not one but three different groups of people doing sometimes also things that were hostile to another was a major policy breakthrough, because it showed how governments can intervene and create institutions that may help the economy move a bit out of the worst of depression. The Swedish economic policy in the 30s was another major experiment. And then the Bretton Woods system, what I've been referring to in my introduction, the system that was created since the end of the Second World War and ensured that there was not a crisis at all in Europe and the industrialized world for 30 years. But then the Bretton Woods system collapsed and we returned to floating exchange rates, and after 1989 to a privatization wave that obviously contributed to the current situation. So my preliminary conclusions are that if we, you know, sometimes there were war conditions around, but the central thing is that at some points weak governments brought microeconomic instability with their action, either by running huge deficits or the overissuing money or indulging the banking system to give to move towards monetary expansion when the economy should actually have slowed down. So government interventions, but also absence of oversight of speculation in where regulations ought to be enforced, no regulations existed. All these created crises like panics and after that, crashes. Let me now move to the Eurozone, and I hope I'm in time. So the Eurozone, the creation of the Euro, defied what economists call optimum currency areas. That is, we have an uneven economic space, and we introduce, and many governments, and we introduce a common currency in the belief that we lower transaction costs and we can live happily together and by defying what some economists believe. The United States is obviously an optimum currency area. It has the dollar, it has regions that are more affluent than others, but it also has a compensation mechanism and a fiscal transfer from the wealthy eastern and western coast to Central America, which is relatively poor. Unfortunately, in Europe, no one thought about this. Perhaps because what happens in Europe is actually a project. It evolves. It started with 6-7 countries, they became 15, they became 27, there is expansion, there is also some deepening, but it's an open project and new policies are introduced when there is a need for a policy to be introduced. So nobody thought in Europe that we should have a policy about financial crisis, and now of course everyone talks about it, but there is a cacophony of voices. Nobody knows which way to go. No, I mean, everyone thinks his way is the most important way, but no one is convinced. To be exact, in Europe, there has been a liberalization of product, capital, and labor markets, but what lacked was a fiscal transfer mechanism, and individual countries in the European Union that entered the Euro weren't told that they had, you know, to move towards harmonizing things like pension systems, tax rates, and how to make the labor market more competitive. Furthermore, the Maastricht Treaty included four criteria for countries to introduce the euro. And one of them, the debt to GDP criterion, was ignored. Not only by Greece, it was ignored by Italy, by Belgium. Even France and Germany at one point exceeded the 60% debt to GDP ratio. So there was, despite it being in the Maastricht Treaty, it was treated like, okay, there was this interpretation, is there a move towards lowering the debt to the GDP ratio? Okay, then the criterion is honored. And the Lisbon Agenda, which still is a major European Union document, is you know, something that appeals to every member state, but not to the member states that are part of the monetary union. So, and the Lisbon Agenda speaks about open coordination, not common policy. Of course, the European Union bureaucracy installed some safeguards. The Stability and Growth Pact being one, and the independence of the European Central Bank the other. So, but if we look back in all honesty, we see that the Stability and Growth Pact didn't really work, because there were penalties to be paid if you made excessive deficits, but no one paid them. No country was forced to pay them. The debt criterion was ignored, and Eurostat, the Statistical Service of Europe, was never assisted in creating accounts, statistical accounts, that could measure at the European level what was really happening, and to provoke the EU bureaucracy to certain action. Now, the euro system has been blamed that it didn't lower the interest rates as much as the Fed did in the United States, but interest rates were very low during the first decade of the 21st century, and this was a period of cheap money, and banks were exposed to risks, and many bubbles, housing bubbles, were created. Many countries exceeded their budget deficit criterion of 3%, and the result was that in the course of the decade we had this picture that some countries, mostly in Northern Europe, were becoming more competitive, were accumulating current account surpluses, whereas other countries, mostly in the southern part, but also Ireland, which is northern, but southern in some respects, were less competitive and created current account deficits. So there was a bomb ticking in the European Union, and now this has exploded because of Greece, but as you know, because of Portugal, Spain, Ireland, now Italy, perhaps French banks, and who knows who comes next. So what does Europe try to do right now? Van Rompuy is heading a commission that will submit proposals for harmonization of fiscal policies. The Euro Plus Pact was agreed. It looks for harmonization of competition. The EFSF was created, but the European Financial and Stability Fund, but it doesn't have the means. It has only a budget of 40 billion, and this is too little for, you know, intervention the European economy, capital markets. Nobody knows how this new institution will evolve. It's in its first steps. and there is a worry that it may not develop to become a fiscal transfer mechanism from the richer to the poorer countries. There is much debate about the role of the ECB, the European Central Bank. According to its statutes, it cannot create money, it cannot intervene like a lender of last resort, in Kindleberger's sense, and the Germans don't want this because they have modeled the ECB to the Bundesbank example. And this is also the reason why Eurobonds are not issued. Individual countries issue bonds, and they are responsible for paying them when they mature. But about the European Union, a federation of countries to create a Eurobond, you understood the obvious juridical problems too. What I see as a spectator in all this is that, you know, time is running out, and this new design and what, you know, European bureaucrats want to get accomplished cannot wait. What we absolutely need is action on many fronts to address the crisis now first, and then to proceed to a new architecture. What I see is more a discussion and a throwing of ideas about creating or making the FSF you know, something new in 6 months' time, in a year's time, or I don't know when. But what we need is action now, and this has to be understood. And so many people think that the decisions of October 27 were too conservative for the seriousness of the situation. What ought to be done, according to me, and I have scattered some ideas here, there are countries that are insolvent, obviously, and some of them that are illiquid. There are banks that were exposed to bad debt, and now their capital base is in danger. This has to be addressed, and something has to be done quickly. It would be a great mistake to leave French banks, for example, you know, fail. The Dexia example is a warning sign. It has to be taken seriously. On the other hand, we have to look into growth, because since we have financial crisis, everyone talks about the world of finance, but finance is not wealth. Real production is wealth. And we have to start, you know, improving the production base of any economy in the European Union and elsewhere. And we have to understand that there is no such thing as an internal prosperity because we created a big single European market. We have to take into account that difficulties are inherent in the economic system, and bad times come after good times, so we have to know that when we live through good times and make arrangements for the bad times that will follow, and thus made them short-lived. My last point is about Germany, and I have to say that I did my postgraduate studies in Germany. I even visited the German school in Athens. I have an Abitur as a young student, and I have many friends in Germany, and we are in contact. And well, they say that Germany is a European country and they are Europeans. But I ask myself, when I, you know, I give them examples about Germany in the interwar period, and about John Maynard Keynes, who showed a remarkable solidarity to the claims that his own government imposed on the Germans. And they say, well, they are European, but you know, I insist that they have to show how European they are. They, you know, that the story between Greece and Germany is very sad at the moment, since the Germans are thought to be extremely cruel to the country. You are going to see the numbers in a couple of minutes. So imposing stiff penalties for, you know, the Greek people that don't lead to anywhere is very absurd and not a European thing. Fortunately or unfortunately, Germany is a major economic player, a current account surplus country, and it can afford to do more for its poorer how should I call this? Not the poor member states of the European Union, in order to get more back from them in the future. Let me go now to Greece, which is something that is also of interest. I don't know how well informed you are, but I would like to start with the two big economic paradigms that have prevailed in Greece since the Second World War. The first was the paradigm of the 50s up to the 80s. I call this a Zolotas Papaliguras model. And the second is the Andreas Papandreou model. Andreas Papandreou was a York University professor, as you know. And his model prevailed, according to me, I'm telling you my personal opinion, up to the present. The first model was a liberal model, but it was not a theoretical model. Zolotas was a central banker. He had this obsession with monetary stability. Since he believed that zero inflation is the way to growth. And his model was instrumental in making Greece a prosperous country. Greece had, for 30 years, very high growth rates, but of course, after the oil crisis, the whole system was starting to tremble, and then one special account was introduced. This is very important. One special account means that because of the difficulties of the oil crisis, the government introduced next to its budget a special account for oil, which was a total deficit, and took this account out of the budget and started, you know, a move towards an intransparency in fiscal matters. During the Papandreou years, 13 special accounts were created, so the picture became totally incomprehensible for the average guy. Papandreou's model was trying to bring socialism through public spending. There was two-digit inflation for a whole decade. The debt-to-GDP ratio jumped from 20% to 110% in 10 years' time. But voters sustained this policy. And this expansionist mentality conquered hearts and minds, and both Kostas Simitis and the right-wing Prime Minister Kostas Karamanlis didn't challenge this model. Simitis modernized it. He, during his years in office, growth was reintroduced in the system, especially through EU funds and the 2004 Olympics, and Karamanlis continued, you know, spending his years in office by spending money. So at one point, his government, the Kostas Karamanlis, made a disclosure of false reporting to Eurostat. Then the socialists, when they came to power, disclosed what the conservatives have done, and they both did, contributed, you know, to people now thinking that Greece entered the monetary union undeservedly. And in May 2010, we have the memorandum of understanding. What about what happens in Greece? Now, this is very important, according to me, that there has been no debate on the causes, about the causes that led Greece to the current situation. There has been no discussion about the mistakes that the Greek governments did when they follow this demand-led growth model with public spending. Instead, what has started is a criticism against the Memorandum of Understanding. Now, the whole discussion is about what the IMF, the Troika, IMF, ECB, and European Union want from us Greeks. And there are four schools of thought. One is not criticizing the memorandum at all. It's a liberal school, and they say fulfill whatever they want from us. This is our obligation. We have to do everything. The second, associated with the Conservative Party, they wanted to renegotiate. But of course, when the Troika is so forthcoming to Greece with billions of bailout money, and they have an agreement with the socialist government, they had an agreement, they didn't want to hear about the renegotiation. So this was obviously not forthcoming to them. It may have helped the Conservative government to win the next election, perhaps. We'll wait and see. Now, more pragmatic is the North-South Europe approach, which asks for Marshall Plan and Eurobonds to rescue the situation in Greece. And there is also a very important, in terms of their influence in the mass media, wave of, you know, demonizing the Fourth Reich and the foreign experts that are sent to Greece as, imperialists, meaning bad and, I mean, they are having a hard time as far as cartoons are concerned in the Greek press. Now, what is the situation? The economy is in a free fall. Unemployment is growing. But public expenditure is still up. And even a respected the Mimon newspaper disclosed in September that in the year of the crisis, 2011, 8,000 new people were hired in the public sector. Now, the economy is, you know, is in a downward spiral. There's not even a market. To quote an example, my wife wants to sell an apartment she has. She wants to, you know, buy out a loan we have taken from a bank. And she cannot find a buyer. I mean, it's not that we have an exaggerated price in our heads. No one shows up. You have no market. I mean, they don't, you know, we may ask for 50,000 euros, but no one comes and says, I have 1,000. What about trade? We may say yes, you know, in the desperate condition we find. But even that doesn't materialize. So we need a new economic paradigm, that's what I think. And there are some good proposals. We have to, of course, sustain low income demand, especially from retired people who now see their pensions becoming simple transfer gifts to them. But introduce some supply-side policies and encourage foreign direct investment. I don't think that exiting the euro is an option. I can tell you more about this during the discussion that will follow. I think that the long-term disadvantages of introducing reintroducing the drachma are far more threatening to long-term prosperity than the short-lived, benefits that you regain power over a national tool of economic policy. So, my discussion of all these issues comes to these three simple things, that in Greece the crisis was due to macroeconomic imbalances that started being built into the system. It's been 30 years. They delivered these policies, Andreas Papandreou's policies, that they delivered some things, especially regional development, but any policy that continues for more than 30 years without correction brings eventually problems. We need a new strategy of economic growth and emphasis on exports. And last not least, we have to get ourselves in Greece a better economic education. Enduring, you know, a situation with huge debts, you know, is unworkable. Everyone has to understand this. It's a fact that we didn't pay attention to this because we thought that since everyone is doing a little better, some did more better than others, but that no one was left behind, this was good, and we could somehow, not proceed with amending fences. But now we have to, you know, get a good economic education and start a new paradigm, and perhaps not make the mistakes that we made in the future. But as I have shown, history does not repeat itself. Events, however, do. So we have to be prepared. Thank you very much for your attention.